Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 27th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks. On a Michael Friday, this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's Casual Friday, Benjamin Dixon, host of The Benjamin Dixon Show. We're breaking down the new Cohen-Trump drama. It's all on tape, but will that make any difference? Plus, the Trump tariff game. Is it the final drama-fueled play of a system that has been the failure since the beginning? And over 20 progressive lawmakers sign a letter protesting the political imprisonment of Lula da Silva and also call for the arrest of Mariela Franco's assassins. Benjamin and I are also going to talk about that. Then Ben Mankiewicz, Turner Classic Movies, The Young Turks. We're talking about why Kimberly Guilfoyle, really left Fox News. And the contradiction of Fox News in a post-global sexual harassment ring environment still being the main propaganda organ of the Trump administration, and he's going to give us a movie recommendation. And then, oh, wait for it, people. Like Cosa Nostra here, we're going to war against Trevor Noah. And I didn't want this war. But literally multiple people sent me things this morning that made the war find me. So it's on Trevor. It involves the worst way to interview AOC imaginable, and a little history lesson in something called the Marikana Massacre. Let me just tell you something, folks. I think all comedy's on the table at all times. But trying to pull off Jerry Seinfeld meets Minor Massacre hybrid mashups, very hard to pull off. And Trevor Noah didn't. Plus, we've got some Rudy Giuliani sound. We've got some Trump bragging about destroying the Affordable Care Act. Bill O'Reilly is most likely extremely drunk and talking about ICE. And the White House says that North Korea has returned the remains of dead U.S. soldiers, which is a good thing. And, of course, very satiating for the thousands of parents of dead Korean War soldiers that talked to Trump about it. Not trying to be a jerk about that, but just remind you of that kind of interesting claim. Republicans endorse Jim Jordan's speaker's bid and make no mention of the sexual abuse that he allegedly ignored. And I don't even know. Here it is. Surprise. Scott Walker is trailing his Democratic challenger by 13 points as Donald Trump's poll numbers sag in an extremely sad fashion across the Midwest. All that and more on today's Casual Friday Majority Report. The four-day work week man is out. The rest of the crew is in. And Michael Cohen is going at Trump. We don't know all of the different machinations here. To be honest with you, I find the idea of Trump paying off women that he had sex with both literally physically nauseating, but also, like, honestly, some of the least offensive things that this guy's ever done in his life. Like, I think the Capone tax evasion comparison is very apt here when we talk about Trump in these stories. I mean, this guy is a hideous human being. And we're talking about everything from, housing discrimination to the Russian mafia to exceedingly credible rape allegations. Like, this is a really awful guy, not to mention everything he's done since he's been in office and promoting racism and xenophobia and everything else. That being said, and of course, none of this Michael Cohen stuff is going to have any effect on the cult base. I think we're already seeing the Midwestern people that maybe were in a deep economic desperation. Maybe we're shaken in by the fraudulent 2016 economic populism. They might already be flipping. I don't think this is going to make any difference with his base. But I do think in the context of the Kavanaugh nomination, the context of just a kind of broad general pressure on right-wing Democrats and on specifically Collins and Murkowski and everybody in the sanctimony caucus in the Republican Senate who enable Trump every day, even as they're super concerned about him being mentally unstable and racist, this type of thing is useful. And now, of course, Michael Cohen, sources close to Michael Cohen say that Trump knew about the meeting that Don Jr. was taking with the Russian lawyer, which, I mean, yeah, I believe that.
To the extent I can really know about anything.
To the extent that I mean know about. That's a very deep existential question. And another person, I mean, this is just literally like the Trump administration is just like a sort of like national vomiting of like all of the worst things about New York City being just inflicted on the rest of us. And here's another person, just a ghoul who, if not in jail, should at the very least be pleasantly out of public life. Rudy Giuliani. This is a funny mashup of his changing opinion on Michael Cohen from March 2018 to July 2018.
Are you concerned at all that Michael Cohen's going to cooperate with prosecutors?
No, I expect that he is going to cooperate with them. I don't think they'll be happy with it because he doesn't have any incriminating evidence about the president or himself. The man is an honest, honorable lawyer.
No, I expected something like this from Cohen. He's been lying all week. I mean, or for two. He's been lying for years. I mean,
okay. I mean, I will definitely say that Rudy Giuliani is definitely a credible person to talk about lying for years.
That's the point about all this. Like, we were talking about when people watch this, they're not getting informed. They're getting the idea that they're informed.
Right.
Like, you're wasting your time. Really, this is just like document how you should treat cable news is how that it documents people perjuring themselves. But like that, you can't trust anything they're actually saying on there, especially like people for this that represent this administration.
There is not a single trend in modern politics from, again, like the racialized policing fused with predatory real estate, Wall Street, down to giving speeches to the terrorist MEK that is instigating for war in Iran that Rudy Giuliani has not been involved in. I mean, this is the one thing I will say about these Trump people. They real like pure, just pure scumbag.
Do you think that Rudy is losing his acuity a little bit, or do you think he just doesn't give a shit anymore if people catch him lying blatantly?
I think it's both and. I think as Barack Obama would say, it's not a question of either or, it's both and. Is Rudy losing his mind? Of course he is. Is he a fundamentally unethical, dishonest swine? Yes.
That's fair.
that's how I would view it.
Did we ever play the video of him dancing in Tel Aviv? I think we might have.
Yeah, I think that led me to say some comments that really upset my grandmother. It was a joke about kites. It was a joke about being willing to do PR work for Hamas, just watching that video alone. Hamas is a right-wing religious organization, so I don't like them. It's not really that complicated. Okay.
And we really don't like kites either.
We hate kites. That's right.
Only thing we hate more than kites is math, people.
That's ooh.
Or maybe like a kite with math on it would be like the worst thing.
That's the worst thing. This is what happens is the baby is at the checkpoint. All right, Israeli impression saved for the fun half. And once again, this is identity politics. I'm partially Jewish. I can do it. All right, we'll be right back with Benjamin Dixon on the Majority Report. She's a Leo.
De Janeiro, Charlie Baltimore, Iceberg Slim, the most shady, Frankie Baby. We here.
Do you know what beef is? Do you know what beef is? Do you know what beef is? Ask yourself, do you know what beef is?
All right, joining us now, I hope he's there. We've had a touch of a technical hiccup, is Benjamin Dixon, host of The Benjamin Dixon Show. Ben, are you there?
I'm here, Mike. How's it going?
Good, man. Sorry about that. Thanks for being here.
Oh, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure as always. Let's start with, we played this clip up front. It was a funny mashup of Rudy Giuliani in March saying, you know, Michael Cohen's a totally stand-up guy. He's not going to bail on us. And now, a couple of months later, he's always been a liar. He's always been a shyster, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
There's tapes now pertaining to these payoffs. Michael Avenatti says he's a couple of other women. They're the same scenario played out. And now we have this accusation about the Russia meeting. I mean, that's just sort of setting the table. What's your read on this, kind of generally speaking? What do you think, it's relevant?
I think it's, of course, it's relevant, right? But how much impact will it actually have on the president? We already know he's a liar, so I don't think it's really going to touch him as much as his son potentially because of his Trump Jr.'s testimony before Congress, possibility of some perjury there. So I think that's the highest stake component of this is what did his son actually testify, and can this testimony from Cohen have any impact in terms of perjury, that kind of thing. But still, again, it doesn't do anything but reveal what we knew about Donald Trump, and there's still a layer of insulation. I don't know how much of this is actually going to reach him.
Yeah, I mean, that's, to me, seems, I mean, also, there's the other element that I said in the beginning as well, which is, like, I actually think, frankly, I mean, I find this sort of Trump behavior actually to be, I mean, it's gross just because it involves Donald Trump and sex. It's probably the least, I mean, this guy, I mean, racial discrimination, Russian and, five families, mafia connections, exceedingly credible allegations of rape, a political career built on lies, oligarchy, and bigotry. I mean, in some ways, it's like, sure. I mean, of course, this would be the, you know, okay. What else could we know about this guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the big thing, Mike. Like, there's really nothing about Donald Trump's character that is going to be surprising to us. And that's a critical component in terms of getting things done politically. Like, you know, right now, the new status quo, even though people always try to say this is not the new normal, don't let this be the new normal. Well, this is the new normal.
Right.
We are used to having a president who is corrupt, who's a liar, who's a alleged sexual assault, sexual abuser, rather. And nothing really is shaking up this collective consciousness enough to actually move people into action on the side of the aisle that action has to come from, at least until November.
Well, that's the question. I mean, do you think that there is a – I mean, look, yes, until November. And I think there's a great two-step process happening right now. There's people like, you know, obviously Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Kaniella Ng, Watud in Massachusetts. I'd add her to the mix. There's a lot of great people running really good democratic socialist and progressive insurgencies. And I think that process inside the Democratic Party, as I've actually said for a long time, it's happening. It's in process, and we're getting some great results, and also we're going to lose some battles as well, but it's happening. And then on top of that, I mean, I guess this kind of basic stance has been mine for a long time, and I would say, you know, doubly so in this cycle. First, you know, the first part is wage these insurgencies, and the second part is you need to give Democrats control of at least one body of government. It's just it's just non-negotiable. It's essential. Yeah. Everybody needs to, and you can pick your degrees of engagement, right? Like not everybody needs to volunteer and work for campaigns and all that, but everybody needs to register and vote and get Democrats in the Senate and House into office in November. It's simply imperative. But besides that, I mean, to me, it's like, to the extent these things could have any benefit, it's on creating heat for procedural questions around for, you know, far right Democrats and for what I call the sanctimony caucus in the Senate for things like Brett Kavanaugh. Like, OK, you're not worried about this guy, you know, handing America to corporations, getting rid of women's rights to choose. But how can you go out and make this big show about being concerned about how uncouth Trump is when you enable this every day? And so I just think this type of thing is just purely based on that margin, if that makes sense.
I mean, I'm piecing that together. So you're basically saying
if you use a story like this to tell people like Joe Manchin on one hand and say Susan Collins, or I mean, particularly actually like Jeff Flake on the other, whatever else, like this isn't about ideology. Of course, this isn't about having any concerns about the actual what this will do to millions of Americans. But it does have to do with, you can't on one hand, particularly in the, that's why I call, you know, the Republican sanctimony caucus. John McCain, Jeff Flake, Susan Collins could today say we are exactly where we've been politically all along, but we are so concerned about the questions of corruption and collusion and the just sort of daily you know, un-Americanness, whatever language they want to use, of this administration, that we're going to become independents and caucus with Democrats and slow up the process because we care about a bigger principle here. Now, I don't think they'll ever do that, but I'm saying that's a way for us to put this stuff on the table, because either to expose their hypocrisy or to put pressure on them to actually do something instead of just tweets and boring speeches.
Yeah, no, okay, I get it. So, I agree. They are emboldening this. They are empowering this. They are the linchpins, right? None of this actually goes forward in terms of Donald Trump's agenda without those core votes that, quite frankly, none of his agenda could get across without some of those votes, and particularly with this justice nomination. So I think it's I think that's a critical approach that not many people have been pushing, what you just said, like actually calling them to become independent and caucus with the Democrats, or just become independent and oppose Donald Trump on some critical issues. But, you know, ultimately, if you look at the approval ratings of Donald Trump in the Republican circles, I mean, they do that at their peril, because Republicans support the madness that's happening right now in our country.
And that leads me to, I mean, and does that in any way surprise you in any way, shape or form?
No, not at all. That's why I didn't even have a follow up statement to it, because that makes total sense. That's where they've been. I mean, this is an inevitable outgrowth of how hyperpartisan, particularly Republicans, have been. You know, people try to all that false equivalence between Democrats and Republicans all getting hyper, becoming more hyperpartisan. But the fact of the matter is that what we're doing, what we're fighting, is an asymmetrical fight. We haven't faced a partisan contingency like the Republican Party. I mean, they've gone so far down the deep end that that it totally makes sense that they would support someone who is Donald Trump.
Yeah, and that we can also look and find any number of precursors for this, right? I mean, with one hand, we can go all the way back. Yep. I did a show on last week on Jesse Helms and the invention of the modern Republican Party. We could look at Joe Arpaio's you know, terrorism in Arizona. We could look at Rudy Giuliani's regime in New York City. This we not to mention Gingrich, not to mention, frankly, Ryan and Romney, even if they try to put a friendlier face on it. This is Republicanism.
This absolutely is. I mean, it, you go back to 2000 with the Supreme Court decision. Right. This one off, this one off decision that they've never done before, but now they've given us George W. Bush for president. And you know, this is the type of hardball politics that Republicans have been playing for a very long time. The most inept part of this entire conversation, the most disgusting part of this conversation, is the fact that some Democrats still don't get it. Chuck Schumer still doesn't get it. Right. They've been playing hardball with this guy for almost 40 years, and he's still thinks that there's a possibility of some type of bipartisanship solution.
Yeah, I just want to get to that in a second, but just to really underline for people who don't remember or don't know, the Supreme Court in 2000 stopped a recount to fully tally the votes in Florida, which, by the way, subsequent reporting showed would have showed that Al Gore won a majority of. Mm-hmm. And the reasoning they used, and I kid you not, was that this process violated George W. Bush's civil rights. So they literally evoked the 14th Amendment and civil rights procedures, which they were gutting even then. And of course, that only accelerated years later with Roberts across the board for like actual people. They evoked it specifically in the person of George W. Bush, and then also explicitly wrote in the decision that this type of reasoning should not be applied to other situations. They literally, and this is not like, that's what they did. I'm not, there's no poetic
there's
license. There's
no exaggeration
here.
Yes. You're not, there's no hyperbole in anything that you just said.
That's what they did. And, you know, that, if anything, should have been, you know, as you say, I agree with you completely. I mean, that should have been the moment of, and this is what really gets me about Schumer, is contrast him with Harry Reid. Harry Reid, you know, conservative Democrat. We have very different policies on any number of things. But the guy, first of all, understood what Republicans were. He's said in interviews, like, he, you know, he's like, I begged President Obama in the beginning to listen to me about who he was dealing with. And he understood it was a knife fight. Yeah. The thing that's amazing about Chuck Schumer is when you have an ideology problem and a wussbaggery problem.
Go ahead and expound on that more.
It's like the word. Well, it's like, you know, you there. I mean, and this is, I mean, not to, I'm very sick of relitigating 2016, but right, that was part of the big problem with Hillary, was like, okay, even if you don't like my politics, I really know how to win and I know how to fight dirty. No, you don't. You know, there might have been a contingent of politicians at some point, and Obama was probably the last of them, frankly, who had a ideological profile that did not fit the needs of the moment by any stretch of the imagination, but they actually knew how to play some hardball and win some fights now and again. And now you have a leadership which is both totally out of date ideologically and doesn't even understand, as a Harry Reid understood, you got to just ground and pound these guys.
Right, right. Well, what's odd, I mean, that's true about Obama in terms of his campaigning, but that wasn't true about him in office.
Yes, exactly right.
That's the most aggravating thing about his entire presidency, was that what he did to Hillary Clinton, he didn't do to the Republican Party as a president.
Precisely.
If he had done that, I mean, we'd have a single payer by now, or at least a public option.
At least not lose 1,000 state races, at least have some governorships, at least have Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court.
Exactly. But you're right. We are dealing with people who are both ideologically out of step and have no spine, collective spine between the entire lot of them.
So what do we, I mean, do you have the optimism, though? I mean, I don't know if I have optimism, but I sort of don't. I don't think it's static. I mean, I think it's happening. Like, at least the fight is happening right now with the Democratic Party.
Yeah. No, I have a lot of hope for the Democratic Party, particularly because of it's not all resting on Ocasio-Cortez, but what she kind of represents, a new wave, and the potential of bringing an entirely new life to the Democratic Party at the highest levels of the Democratic Party. We're not talking about someone who's a rising star in the party. She is the star of the party at this point, and so quickly. So the potential is there for more people to do that. And what we have have to be careful of as leftists is that we don't sabotage this moment by saying that she's not socialist enough. Right. Well, you know what? She's damn it. She's socialist enough for me right now. You know, she's the best thing that we've have that we've got next to Bernie Sanders or right next to Bernie Sanders. Pretty much the same thing. But I had to just be careful for the audience. But the point is that if we look at her and we think that she's not enough, and that we think the best option is for us to not participate, then we would do what so many leftists have done. We will sabotage our own potential for power. And this is the closest thing that we've gotten. So we need to push even harder for more people. You know, don't let her be a star alone, because there's so many more talented leftists who are just waiting for their opportunity to get on the national stage. I think we should seize it, you know, in terms of just the Democratic Party as a whole. You know, we don't need to put them in. You know, we have to wait to 2020 before they get the White House. So that's plenty of time for us to actually put people in place so that when Democrats do get into power, they actually make decisions that matter. They do it from a ideologically consistent perspective of what the country is looking for at the moment, as well as with a backbone and with a spine to do and to undo some of the things that Donald Trump has done. We, you know, can you imagine getting a mealy-mouthed, soft-spoken Democrat to become president after Donald Trump who wants to go back to bipartisanship? I couldn't stomach the thought of that. We need a fighter who's going to come in and fight like hell to undo all the madness that Donald Trump has done over the last few years.
And get what needs to be done, you know, what already needed to be done to address all the pre-existing crises.
Exactly.
And I think the other thing, too, that also to me, and we touched on this yesterday, look, not only like, OK, I think, again, nobody's above, you know, this is the same principle Bernie. I think Bernie Sanders is great. I am still a defender of him against, I think, just any number of, frankly, just baseless attacks. At the same time, I'm totally willing to have, you know, a fair and smart critique to help him get better. Same principle applies to Ocasio-Cortez.
Right.
But the thing is that is it's like if you want Ocasio-Cortez to be as great as she can be, if you want Bernie to be as great as he can be, if you also want other people don't have the same profile but have actually been really good as well. I'm thinking of a Barbara Lee as an example who I really want to get into House leadership. Then what you need to do is get Kaniella Ng in there, get other candidates in there so that they're part of a pack and a tribe. That's right. The context by which they get better and better.
I mean, people understand this intuitively, right? That because you do the same thing on Twitter, right? Leftism is growing because we have a tribe now, right? Socialism is growing because we have a tribe. Marxist-Leninism is growing because they have a tribe. It makes total sense. But what is happening instead is that people are tearing down the potential that we have simply because they aren't as this particular candidate isn't as perfect as they need them to be, or because of the intellectual thing to do now, or the pseudo intellectual thing to do now, is to be a critic of the Democratic Party instead of trying to actually change the Democratic Party. People see more value, social value online, to just be a critic of the Democratic Party without doing anything to replace the Democratic Party from within or from without, for that matter.
Well, yeah, I mean, because I think across the board for all this stuff, we need strikes, we need protests, we need occupations, we need, you know, I would love to see, and I've talked with some people in DSA about it, I'm excited, I would love to see DSA policy groups start putting out practical roadmaps.
Yes.
Like, how do we nationalize the oil and fossil fuel industry within the next 5 to 6 years? How do we nationalize companies like Google? Because I think actually it is a real concern with DSA specifically. It's like, okay, take the win that Medicare for All is becoming a mainstream position and keep pushing like hell on it, because even if it's mainstream, the most powerful forces in society are still going to fight it
or fight against it. Yeah.
But then the way I think that you really keep distinguishing a DSA is, including, of course, grassroots things for things like renter and tenants' rights in a place like New York City. But then it's also to start putting out like, hey, that's awesome. So glad that Kristen Gillibrand and Cory Booker and people like that have caught up on postal banking and these types of really great things. Mm. Well, we have a plan that would make, you know, Exxon completely government taken over in 6 years and redistributed as a commons. What's your thoughts on that? And by the way, and there's another way for Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez and real left to keep proving their bona fides. And I think obviously in their case, I think they want to go there anyways. But I think that's how you – and then the other dynamic that's emerging that I'd like your thoughts on too, which I actually take as encouraging, is there's been some articles that have come out on – you know, Elizabeth Warren's in a bit of a different category because she might run for president, but specifically Jeff Merkley and Brian Schatz, who to me, that's another sign of a win because they're liberal progressives in a positive sense, not our politics. We're to the left of them, but they have some very genuine and serious commitments. You know, Merkley was out of the gate on the ICE kidnappings. Schatz has produced serious proposals on college, on climate. They're both signed up for Medicare for All. Merkley endorsed Sanders. And their goals are to get Senate leadership positions as people that can synthesize the Democratic caucus, but from the left, not as corporate wuss bags.
I love it. You know, that's the hope. I mean, there's obviously going to have to be a leadership change because what's been happening is not tenable, right? The leadership that we have and it has to come from a leftist perspective, but we have to be reasonable about how far the next left leadership is, right? So I think that that's a reasonable step in the right direction. Obviously we want to go even further left in the long run, but you know, we're not going to have Che lead us in the Senate in the next 2 or 3 years, but you know, we can move in the right direction because we can't stay with what we have. And if we don't put this goes back to what you say. Give them a squad. Give them a tribe there, because without that, there is no left leadership in the Senate or the House particularly. And so this is all the more reason we have to engage in this political system. I mean, more now more than ever.
And by the way, I just want to add, we're pivoting in a second, but actually I should add, I interviewed both Allison Hartson and Kevin DeLeon on Michael Brooks' show. And of course, I was, you know, much closer to Hartson in terms of politics, but I would add that to the mix. You have a choice now between, you know, a solid center-left guy who's got some good instincts, who came around to the right position on ICE, who's been serious about climate and expanding healthcare and immigrants' rights, versus a far right national security Democrat. Vote for Kevin DeLeon in California. Like that is a tangible improvement right there. If you replace a Kevin DeLeon with a over Dianne Feinstein, you know, it doesn't always have to be, you know, that isn't as exciting as Ocasio-Cortez or Kaniella.
No.
That's my politics. But it's a real improvement.
Right. But you know, the thing is we've intellectualized disenfranchising ourselves. That's right. Honestly where we are in terms of the left. We're actually there in the black community as well. It's the intellectual thing to do to abstain from participating in this, and particularly from an incrementalist perspective, right? If you're talking incrementalism, then you're just as bad as a corporate neoliberal shill, right? And that is the perfect formula to keep you out of power in perpetuity.
I agree completely. I want to touch on this tariff stuff for a minute with Trump. Two parts of it that I want your thoughts on. One, we saw the big threat with China. Then China sort of soothed him by giving a company he has in Indonesia a deal, which is like peak Trump. And then, you know, with the Europeans, it basically was, I mean, much lower stakes, but essentially the same as North Korea. Bunch of dramas created, and then they sit and him and Juncker announce an agreement, which is really just aspirations. It's like, yeah, one day we'll have this tariff-free relationship. But it does strike me, I mean, trade is particularly an area, though, where the frame that, oh, my God, look at what Donald Trump is doing, is profoundly insufficient. Trade has always been, particularly in modern era, particularly under WTO rules, unfortunately, that is an area of real, at the presidential executive level, bipartisan consensus on writing the rules of the road in favor of corporations and in ways that are incredibly harmful to labor, to the environment, to public health across the board. Even this Trump breastfeeding thing at the UN, I'm sorry, yes, it's totally disgusting, but no, Obama, Bush, and Clinton did very similar things, including, you know, in the late 90s, the Clinton administration's approach to generic AIDS drugs in South Africa was one of the most moral obscenities you could imagine. And I actually think for that Midwest strategy, that's another area where Democrats are going to really need to come up with, and the grassroots is going to really need to come up with, what does an actual fair trade system look like?
Mm. You know, I was reading the post, the article by Zach Carter in Huffington Post, and he was expounding on the problem. You know, it's obviously these things pre-existed Donald Trump. I mean, you said as much just now. But Donald Trump is taking a hatchet to the problem that really needs precision in terms of how do we unravel what has become a free trade on the international stage, this interdependency that we have between nations. How do we unravel that to something that is fair trade, and how do we do it in a way that does not destroy more than it does any good? Donald Trump is not out to do anything good here.
Of course.
Yes, we do need fair trade. And I think that is the framing that we should have this conversation in. I think we should seize on the opportunity that Donald Trump is creating by bringing light to the problems of this, by trying to bring a hatchet job to this. You know, he is bringing a lot of light to the problem. But we should seize upon that to do the right thing. And I think that's the case in so many things that Donald Trump does. He stumbles onto the right area for the wrong reason.
Right.
And he becomes this idiot like a bull in a china shop, just destroying things. But in reality, there's some things about the china shop that we actually need to fix. And I think if we don't seize the opportunity to make substantive changes for the good, then we will allow Donald Trump to do all of the damage without anything good coming from it.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And I think that this also underlines, I know we've talked about this before, but just how awful the media coverage was that drew this lazy symmetry between Sanders and Trump. And they would say, mm-hmm. Oh, you know, these guys are both upset at the system and they're both critical of trade agreements. Bernie Sanders was talking about changing trade agreements to basically create labor solidarity and enhance conditions.
Right.
And to the extent that Trump, and that people really need to remember this, to the extent he was ever specific about it, was saying things like Americans make too much money.
I honestly forgot that he said that.
Do you remember that?
I recall it now, but wow. It's the same thing with any of the trade deals that he's talking about. He's not talking about fixing the problem that we have with the system. He's talking about fixing the problem that he sees with the system. And you have to realize who Donald Trump is. He is a capitalist. I mean, he is a neoliberal, right, from that perspective. So, you know, if you think he's trying to fix something, with the TPO, like, you know, the things that he's trying to fix are not the problems that we have with the system, right? He's doing favors. It's amazing how many of the things that he does are for like personal favors for people he knows. Like he'll make changes to the entire system for one individual. Well, you know, just because he's addressing trade doesn't mean he's addressing it from the perspective that we as leftists want him to address it. And so I think that is the danger, both in terms of the media's laziness in their reporting, but also with how he lulled some people. I don't know what percentage it was, but some people were lulled into supporting him because he had the language of a populist.
Right.
In actuality, he's as much a capitalist as anybody else in the system.
That's exactly right. And I think that also illustrates the other, like, well, one good way of telling the difference between an actual, you know, genuine populist, progressive, or socialist analysis versus the pseudo-populist, far-right reactionary, and in fact, hyper-corrupt capitalist that you're talking about is, what order of thing are we talking about, right? Like, Brexit, obviously, I think is, you know, it's pound for pound. I get that there's a left critique of the EU, which I find credible, but Brexit's a bad idea. But the big thing is like, is somebody going to you and saying that there is a problem that affects the UK, staying on that, and the whole European Union, and that problem is the EU, the euro as a currency was designed in a way that, you know, followed the rules of the gold standard, which are reactionary, which are right-leaning in terms of monetary policy. There's a problem in terms of austerity. Like, there is a capitalist problem that has affected the UK in terms of stagnation, massive inequality, and all of the problems we have across the world in a deregulated neoliberal environment. And that's the problem. And if somebody says to you, even when they're saying things and making noises about things that are real, inequality, wage stagnation, yeah, insecurity, and then they go, and it's that bureaucracy, and we could solve it by this second order thing. That's always the tip off. I mean, sometimes obviously it's as blatant as, you know, the reason is because of, you know, immigrants or whatever, and the racism is obvious. But even when they're not going there explicitly, if they're talking about something that isn't just like capitalists writ large, like capital is a problem. It isn't a specific problem because of the Eurozone rules. It's a problem, right, because it's a problem.
It's a problem, right.
You know, right, and you got to catch that.
Yeah, and I would hope those of us, you know, this is why, if I could just kind of be cliche here, this is why independent media is so important, right? Yeah. This is why your show is important. This is why what all of us do is important, is because we have to translate these things. It's not that the people can't do it on their own. They're totally capable of doing this. But you know what? When you're trapped in this system, you really may not have enough time to really delineate the difference between what this particular politician is saying as a critique of capitalism or critique of our current system and what this politician is saying as a true critique of capitalism, as a true way of getting class solidarity, international class solidarity, right? And yep. So it's important that we have these conversations, because it's never going to happen on mainstream media. Not, I don't know in our lifetime if it will ever happen on television or in the mainstream news. But it's so critical, because the sleight of hand is so insidious. Donald Trump mastered it. I don't even think he meant to master it, but he understood that if he could communicate in the language of populism, in the tone of populism, he can actually exacerbate the problem of the people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I just want to touch on Brazil with you briefly. People know that obviously on both you know, my show and Majority Report, I've been covering this a lot. And there's a letter, and this also, I think, again, actually underlines our earlier point about who you get into Congress. But 29 Congress people signed a letter, including Bernie Sanders, Barbara Lee, Maxine Waters, Keith Ellison. Yep. It was organized by Mark Pocan, who's actually also a good progressive from Wisconsin, who helped organize against TPP. And it not only calls, denounces the quote-unquote highly questionable and politicized imprisonment of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. It also states that the fight against corruption should not be used to justify the persecution of political opponents or denying them the right to participate in free elections. Of course, Lula leads in elections, even though he's been imprisoned on very flimsy evidence for several months. The person second to him in the elections is a quite literal fascist, someone who's talked about restoring military rule in Brazil. And the letter also talks about the austerity regime of Michel Temer right now, which came into office through removing Dilma Rousseff from office and is using, brutal austerity and basically reversing all of the social gains of the Lula government, which took 40 million people out of poverty. And I also want to just add major cloud on Obama and Kerry here, because this was heating up really in 2014, 2015, and they did nothing in terms of looking at a very dangerous, very politicized situation in Brazil, which was clearly a tool of oligarchs to reassert control. And I just want your thoughts on this, I guess, both from a U.S. and Brazil perspective. I know we've chatted about it off mic.
Yeah. You know, particularly from the U.S. perspective, I think this is why you can't minimize the importance of another voice. Right. Because we would have seen participation from the opposite side for purposes of oligarchy, for the purposes of corporatism across global corporatism. But now we have voices that are speaking out on the issue that, quite frankly, I'm surprised that we got that. Not because of the people who were on the letter, like the letter was signed, Maxine Waters, Barbara Lee, like you said, Bernie Sanders, Ro Khanna. I expect that from those people, but to have it organized and presented to actually be participating on an international stage in a positive way, right? The United States as a can have the positive impact that we should have had all along, that you can't minimize the importance of having every individual leftist voice that we can get into Washington, D.C. From the Brazil perspective, you know, it's I'm not an expert. I mean, I guess none of us are experts on these fields, but just really specifically the opportunity for power to change and to control that next step. Like this is a very important decision. This is a very important election. And what happens after this, this is the pivotal moment. Right. And so the ability for people in power to pull the chains of power, to maintain power, we can't minimize how important that is and look at that as a model of what could potentially happen in other nations. And right. So this is like something we've seen historically. It's like a playbook that people in power who want to control it. And we're not talking about individual people so much as regimes, right?
Right.
The right-leaning regime wants to remain in power. And so of course it's going to do everything it can to maintain that power, even if it means the violation of human rights, civil rights, and anything else. So, but yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all I have on that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. And I also just think it's also another important thing to look at. It's another rhetoric to be very mindful of. Like AMLO has an anti-corruption campaign, which is connected with the problems of inequality and oligarchy in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
In Brazil, mm-hmm. a generic campaign about corruption, which, by the way, corruption is an issue that the current president who's implementing austerity is literally on tape talking about bribing people. And there's a very clean case you can make that to the extent that the Workers' Party and even Lula himself, although there's been, as I say, the evidence against him is would not pass muster with any kind of rigorous process, but that they actually acquiesce to a degree of participation in corruption because that's the only way you can acquire any kind of power in Brazil. In fact, that very similar, in fact, to the type of people who make a kind of realistic argument about some of the compromises that somebody like Obama made. And frankly, if we're being real, Lula certainly delivered a lot more for people in poverty than Obama did here. But that being said, I think that it's another good example that just – of course, anti-corruption is an important issue, and of course, it matters a lot if you believe in left politics and government
right.
democracy. But at the same time, it's another thing that shouldn't – it doesn't float in space by itself.
Right.
And if it isn't connected to a broader critique and understanding of politics, power, and things, by the way, that we don't call corrupt but are innately corrupt, like – oligarchs controlling all of a country's resources,
right.
Then it's going to not only not address the problems, it's going to be harnessed to do what they're doing to Lula specifically, but it also, you know, implement austerity, this assassination of Mariela Franco, which the
right.
letter also represents. It's going to be used in a very corrupted way, ironically, to actually really just reassert oligarchy, which is what's happening in Brazil.
Well, that, I mean, and that is the power of it, though, right?
Yeah.
You know, you give a simple phrase like corruption and it neutralizes people who otherwise would oppose you. And notwithstanding the fact that the current regime is corrupt, right? But this is the importance of communication. This is the importance of being able to break that barrier of people who see the word corruption and then they either fall out of the conversation, they become disillusioned, and they don't fight anymore. But then the reality is that the people who are claiming corruption are corrupt themselves, and they're claiming corruption to maintain their corruption. It's like it's a sleight of hand that is happening in the United States every single day,
right.
for that matter. But
right.
but if people don't understand the game, if people don't understand the spin, then they could become demoralized and the fight diminishes. And that's what we have to be able to do, help them to do, at least here in the United States, is to understand the game that's being played on us and to not let it demoralize us because they are doing exactly. I mean, they're master propagandists. That's all I have to say. They're master propagandists globally.
One of the best people for helping you understand the game that is being played is my friend Benjamin Dixon, and you can find his work at The Benjamin Dixon Show. There's going to be a link, of course, to his show page, and you can find him on Twitter. Indispensable source. Ben Dixon, thanks as always.
Hey, Mike, it's always a pleasure, man.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, and I should say, I just heard the Boston DSA does have a plan to nationalize
oil or tech
National Grid.
Awesome.
It's a campaign to
nationalize what we need. That's exactly, and I want to see that across a whole suite of policy areas, a whole suite of policy areas.
Oh, for sure.
That would be amazing. And that's another way, when you talk about making sure that the DSA stays as a distinctly socialist and radical one, you start doing that by continuing to put policies on the table that continue to push the envelope for democratizing the economy.
For sure.
All right. Can you guys vamp for 1 second? I'm going to call Ben. All right. We will
vamp.
No, we'll go to music. That should be fine. All right. We will be right back with Ben Mankiewicz from Turner Classic Movies and the Young Turks.
Chronics are where you say, hey. Sunshine, rivers, and trees. Relief. Wait, hey.
When me see Jah, me see a way. Drastically straight from hypocrisy, I say, hey. Every man to them own a philosophy. I live the proper way and then me read a chapter daily. Man, they in a city hungry and no eat. And food they down a country, does a drop off of the tree then. You see, say poverty no real then. Is what the reason revealing.
To my friends and foes, and I suppose I'm pleased to be chilling in the West Indies. Jah provide all my wants and needs. I got the sunshine, rivers, and trees. Green leaves, yeah.
When the rain pits up at 20 roof, herb just a steam, pepper pot 20 stew. Life is a dream if you got gratitude. So go tell the regime, them can't stop where we do now. Information you think on your own, or else you're a slave to the things that you know. What do you know if you learn every day? So be careful of things where you say.
Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? I just go where the trading blows, sending love to my friends and foes. And I suppose I'm pleased to be chilling in the West Indies. Jah provide all my wants and needs. Sunshine, rivers, and trees, green leaves.
Africa in our soul, but a Jah in our heart. It is of importance for I and I gather. If we cannot show now a balance that we had, how do we propose then to carry it abroad? Cannot go to Ethiopia and you not have a plan. The building of a nation and a helper and every one a lover, one a man is just a man. It shall be a coronation when we land, land, land.
Who knows? I'm pleased to be chilling in the West Indies. I provide all my wants and needs. I got the sunshine, rivers, and trees. Really, well.
Chronics and Protege, who knows? Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Ben Mankiewicz. He's a host of Turner Classic Movies, co-host of The Young Turks. Ben, thanks for being here.
Michael, how are you?
Doing great, man. How are you?
I'm well. I'm on vacation in the Poconos.
In the Poconos, huh?
Have you
been there before?
Where sort of my wife kind of grew up. It's a complicated place, the Poconos, but it's interesting.
I've never been, actually.
Yeah, it's fine. You'll be okay. But if you have to go, it's okay. It's all right. No, actually, some of it is...
Is there any good nosh there?
There is not any good nosh.
There's no good nosh.
Did you go to one of those...
No, you have to eat at the club.
What did you say?
You have to eat at the club.
What's the club?
The golf and tennis and pool club. And that is not an experience that I'm entirely comfortable
with. Wait, will you talk about that and particularly the levels of anti-Semitism you experienced?
Well, first of all, the people here in this town are actually pretty great. But there is a sort of, you know, the Poconos, some of it was just devastated by the economic crash in 2007 and has just not recovered.
Yeah.
And so there's this sort of abject... poverty, surrounded by not really opulence, but certainly, you know, people who from New York and Philadelphia who have second homes here. But this place is so remote that really the only, not the only restaurant, but sort of the restaurant people end up going to is the place at the golf and tennis club. And these are my wife's friends, and they're good people, and there are plenty of liberals out here. But on the 4th of July, I was here earlier in the first week of July, and I just came back to see my wife and daughter and bring them all back to L.A. with me. And
escape from the Poconos with the Mankiewiczes. Like, you know, went back to get them back to L.A.
I have to ask, were you staying at one of those love hotels with a heart-shaped hot tub?
The Hotel Madonna. I've had a meal at the Hotel Madonna.
Nice.
I've got accused. That's in San Luis Obispo. No, but there are those places here. No, of course. There's plenty. We rented a house. We did the. The amount of money you end up paying for a house here for it doesn't have a pool, that bothered me. But the whole thing bothered me. But nonetheless, that's not the point. Let's continue on. Let's.
The whole thing bothered you. I love it.
So on the 4th of July, there's this great, fabulous picnic. And there's fireworks, and they do an egg toss, and they do a balloon toss, and all these sort of fun, and all these kids are there, and it's great. Now, you do have a moment where you look around, and you think, you know, if in 1938, outside Berchtesgaden, Hitler had said, you know, guys, let's get all our families together, and we'll have a big picnic, and we'll play a bunch of games, the crowd would have looked similar. That was sort of my takeaway.
Did you share that? Did you share that with people?
I did, which they were all they're aware of what this. But anyway, but the fact
they gave
is, I mean,
you some
like,
Midwest like, charm. They were just like, oh, that's true. It would be like Hitler. Yeah, it's a good joke.
No, and it's so.
And
no,
then you laughed and you're like, that Jew TV bastard.
No, they're not. The great thing is that there is a little flashback to a simpler time. Like a bunch of parents here won't know where their kids are. And they'll be like, oh, they're over at the Stoffingtons having. I did just pick a very German name, but they're over at somebody else's house. She's feeding them dinner. Like kids wander around.
I like that. They're over at the Waffen SS aftercare program.
All right. Yeah, this is a mistake. Thankfully, this isn't going public, so it'll be fine.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm sure nobody from the public.
Yeah, my wife will be like, hey, can I listen to your thing? I'm like, no. It's a practice.
Oh, come on. Yeah. Of course she can watch. I got the permission to hang out with her once. She's very cool.
It's good. It's a fun place to be, and my daughter's having a great time.
Oh, that's awesome. We did have Matt. I don't know if you can play sound. We did have that. Okay, you need a minute. All right, we're gonna get you. I do want to play some great Bill O'Reilly sound of his new career, but before we get there, there was a. Really funny. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say this is funny, but whatever. It was an objectively funny piece about Kimberly Guilfoyle that dropped today in Huffington Post. And
yes, I read it. Yeah.
Yes. And a couple of things about this. I mean, first, her team obviously tried to do, you know, a week or two ago or whenever it was, like, you know, she wasn't pushed, she walked. And they hit her on background with a piece today that was. You know, hilarious, disgusting, and also just really bizarre, because it was like, I have a take on it. I want to ask you about, but give me your initial reactions to the piece first.
Well, I didn't take it as partly because, you know, it's Yasir Ali, and he's so unbelievably patched in, the reporter, with sort of the Me Too movement and having people open up to him. So, you know, there were 21 sources he had. I didn't see it as a Fox pushback, but as soon as you said it, I'm like, oh, all right. It's a lot of people to be involved in a pushback, which suggests that some may have sort of approached him authentically, and he is the place where people would go to.
Right.
That said, I had a number of different reactions. One of them was, on one level, until I read the part about her yelling at the hair and makeup people, which, again, it just blows my mind that anybody would ever do that
at any point.
You know?
It's so gross.
Yeah, you don't talk to these people who are there to serve you and make you look better, you know.
Right.
You just be grateful every second that job exists for somebody to help you look better. But I thought she, you know, showed pictures of male genitalia, so says the story. This is a woman who tried to play along in the culture at Fox.
And had you guess, it was the thing was that she would show a picture and then she would try to have you guess. which man it was.
That does sound, I'll right. be honest, that sounds like a fun game.
That does sound like kind of a fun game, actually. I was like, I definitely read the piece and I was like, if she wasn't such a totally horrible person, in some ways she sounds pretty fun to hang out with.
But yeah. This is a woman who tried to be one of the boys, and then even that came back and bit her. So on that sense, I had sympathy. Like, she played the game.
Right.
Now, playing the game by calling up and saying, when Ailes was still there, are you on Team Roger or Team Gretchen for Gretchen Carlson? That is not trying to play along. That's sort of hideous and divisive. But I just imagine sort of being faced with a choice, which, of course, millions of women have had to, of like, do I say, hey, enough of this crap? Or do I, hey, okay, great, fine, let's go drink and I'll try to play golf. I'll talk right. about sex. I'll be the body girl who talks about sex. And then that comes back to bite her. That seems
Sorry?
I said that seems a little unfair to me.
Right. Sort
of, that comes back to bite her after she tries to play along and be bawdy.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, I kind of thought to myself, what was funny about this, I mean, there's sort of like three things. I mean, one is a great reminder that, like, up until 2016, this place was like essentially a global sexual harassment ring. And, right. you know, like, and she's... And I'm also reminded, I don't remember what article it was in. I think it was something that either Gretchen Carlson said in her book or Megyn Kelly, but that, you know, Ailes sort of, and by the way, and, you know, he said this, I mean, just to like fully get the picture, it wasn't like a, you know, he said this with like kind of a, I pictured sort of like a gross smile on his face. I guess, I don't know what other way you could picture Roger Ailes smiling, but he supposedly called, you know, Kimberly Guilfoyle a Puerto Rican whore, quote unquote. And in like a, you know, she's one of us sort of thing, right? And even right, just having that, all of that in background, I mean, just the implications of that statement on so many levels and how grotesque that is. And the fact, so you have Fox till 2016, raw sexual harassment culture. Then you have this, you know, and then the Kimberly Guilfoyle, I think you're right. I think, and look, I think especially, as you said, when it comes to like terrorizing the assistants, I mean, that's just a sign of a bad person. I can get into a fair amount of moral relativity, but when you're talking about somebody who, you know, is in a situation like that, if you're bullying somebody who's just objectively lower on the totem pole, is just there to assist you, you're a bad person. There's no other way of getting around it. And at the same time, right, she was trying to play in the boys' club, and now she gets the shaft, which kind of, the third part of it, which is bizarre to me, which is like, okay, I guess Fox News, it's like, no, now we're going to be this modern 21st century environment where you can't like sexually terrorize women anymore. You can't say overtly racist things to black people in IT or whatever the hell else was going on there. And then at the same time, we're still the main propaganda network for a, you know, overtly misogynist, white supremacy-based administration. But it's just internally now, oh, yeah, now we're going to be really nice and PC. And it's like, wow,
yeah,
that's
look,
a bizarre contradiction.
Right. We can, you know, right. look, it's a complicated world, and I suppose we should give Fox credit and Murdoch credit for putting a stop to the thing that I imagine it didn't occur to him he even had to stop for.
Right.
For 20 years of being this sort of factory of sexual harassment, but it's still Fox, and that's still an enormously profitable business right now to be the propaganda arm of the Trump administration.
And I think it's also, and I think, you know, obviously in the Trump era, Alex Jones and all these other things are incredibly important, and they're part of the Republican brain trust. But Fox News is still, you know, that's still the Death Star, as it were.
Oh, no question. You know. Yeah. I mean, Alex Jones is nothing compared to Fox News. I mean, Alex Jones is a sad day for him. 30 days off of Facebook, right? No Alex Jones.
Oh, right. I heard about that. Yeah, no Alex Jones. I do get somewhat, I think, because I don't trust the editorial sophistication of Facebook. Whenever I hear that, I mean, great. You know, screw Alex Jones. He's a menace, although he is a talented broadcaster, I hate to admit. But, you know, I get concerned, I guess, about, like, is that process going to really draw smart distinctions about what is and is not credible content? You know, because
I mean, Alex Jones should be banned from Facebook. You know,
I think Alex Jones specifically should. I buy that totally. But I remember when this started happening, you know, there was a good piece, I forget where it was, but it sort of, you know, it was basically making the point that, well, I'll give you a direct example, and fortunately, I mean, this ended up being fine. But, you know, recently on a Michael Brooks show, I did a long format show with Anthony LaPay, who's a executive producer and showrunner for this History of the Drug War in America, on which I think was on the History Channel. But it was actually a really smart and very well-reported series. And we did a series, the illicit history of opioids, everything from the, you know, corporate malfeasance to Chapo's role in it to failure in governmental policy. And this stuff, you know, it implicates policymakers, American corporations, the pharma industry, and there's nothing conspiratorial about it, right? But I could see if it, you know, an algorithm that's just looking for, oh, you know, CIA complicit in, you know, trafficking out of Nicaragua in the 80s. Well, that's just true. But if you're just looking, you know, if you're just using a metric that says like anything, you know, maybe that's the same metric that says, you know, that the government has a moon child molestation base or whatever the hell else goes on.
Well, it's a little like it lacks the. It's true and important. And I love it. I will instantly start watching that. But
right.
You know, but it's not that different than James Clapper lied to Congress.
Yeah.
Therefore, everything anyone in intelligence says must be dismissed out of hand. Like, oh, right. Why did you start listening? You know, I'm like, yeah, I got it. I must say, although he did unquestionably lie to Congress, I don't suspect the Director of National Intelligence was going to reveal a program that they were doing that was almost certainly illegal, and certainly they wanted to keep quiet in an open session of Congress. Like, and I don't instantly sounds like I'm making excuses for him. I just mean, like, that is not the world we live in, where he goes, yeah, you got us. Good question, man. We're collecting bulk data.
Fucking Wyden, man. He nailed it.
I was so hoping you weren't going to ask that,
dude.
Ronnie. Yeah.
Wyden, he just turns into Will Ferrell.
Right.
Why did you ask that question? Well, or as I always say in these conversations, yeah, the American intelligence services lie frequently. You know other intelligence services lie? All of them.
Yeah, all of
right,
them.
Right.
Right. That does not mean that we lose the ability
right.
to assess their information as credible or not every time they speak it. Anyway, but that's
yeah,
all
no, indeed.
So, yeah, I mean, hear you.
Well, there's always a pre and a post critique to everything. Yeah, but I just think the other thing I would want to put on the table too was also that, you know, we covered this yesterday, but Fox News putting out that statement that they stand in solidarity with the CNN reporter who was kicked out for asking the Michael Cohen question, that press release is put out on the same day that Lou Dobbs gets, you know, himself into a lather about it's time to treat the president with respect, and if you don't, there are consequences, which is like literally authoritarian sentiment, right? Like, I mean, it's like...
Because he lacks the talent of Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly. You mentioned Alex Jones is a good broadcaster, and
right.
I agree with that. I thought O'Reilly was a great broadcaster.
Well, we're going to get
right?
to him in a second.
The Lou Dobbs isn't.
No.
And therefore sort of floats under the radar, but he is as bad or worse than Hannity and more
yeah.
alarming in many
yeah.
ways.
Right.
And that hair color is unidentifiable anywhere in the color spectrum, too. He's like 96 years old and has that color hair.
Yeah, it's like, welcome back. The only good thing that black people ever did was Red Fox gave me a suggestion for this hair color. Now here's a fucking Mexican segment. All right, Ben, you say that Bill O'Reilly was a great commentator, and good broadcaster. I remember a joke. I don't remember who told it, but it wasn't me. I wish I could give somebody credit. They said, you know, I hate all of them, but Bill O'Reilly is talented. Sean Hannity looks like a gym teacher who won a raffle to get a TV show, just sentiment that I totally agree with. This is Bill O'Reilly now at BillO'Reilly.com. And
sure.
I just want to play this clip. I want to see if you have any speculation about maybe anything, Bill O's state of mind is how I'll put it. And I also want to know if you're still going to stand by the great broadcast or good broadcaster moniker after you hear this. Check this out. This is Bill O'Reilly talking about ice polling.
All right. So there was a poll conducted by Pew. Pew's pretty good. P-E-W. And they ask people if they have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of ICE. ICE, I love this. So, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Do you have a favorable opinion of ICE? And it was 47% said no. No, we don't like ICE. 44, yes, we like. That's within the margin of error. So it's a tie. So half the Americans say, we like ICE. We need immigration enforcement. We need border patrol. We need it. And then 47%, no, they're too mean. They're mean. Now, that's totally 100% media-driven. 100%.
I would just like to say, I don't know if people's natural moral reactions to watching kids get kidnapped and then held hostage is just pure media drive. It might just be a basic moral sentiment getting activated. But
no, nope, all the media. All the media. I had no opinion on kids being abducted by government agents until CNN, that liberal bastion CNN, told me to be outraged. Yeah, so I would say Bill O'Reilly needed a producer and a scripted show to be a really good broadcaster, because that was bad. Not the sentiment. The sentiment was always bad, right? He's capable of relaying that sentiment on the old O'Reilly factor, but he would have done it in a far more skilled fashion. I'm not saying would have convinced people either. I just mean he has all the ability to take what someone said, turn it, twist it, throw it back to them in a way that makes them defensive and do it on the fly is... There's a fair amount of skill in that, right? I mean, he used a very useful skill, and he used it for evil. But it was unquestionably a skill that didn't reflect it. And then, of course, the actual content of what he said is wrong. You know, we protected the borders and had in border enforcement before there was ICE. So we're not really, when we say disillusion, get rid of ICE, we're not really saying, and don't patrol the border at all. Just open it up. He's back to his normal tactics of sort of deliberately misleading. I don't know whether you know this about me, but for 3 or 4 years now, the best thing I've done, best opinion I've had, was that ICE has the worst name ever, and that it is dangerous when we start giving cops with that kind of ability to enforce against weaker people a badass nickname. Like, not supposed to be cool, right? You're not supposed to be, I'm with ICE, right? No, I mean, if you want to change it to the Bureau of Border Enforcement, you know, the BBE, that's not cool, and I could live with that. And I think that does send a message. I mean, again, it's propaganda. It's subtle, but we give these guys, these cops, these badass ICE T-shirts, and they give them a badass name, and then eventually they have too much power. So the issue isn't abolishing them. It's changing the name and reducing the power.
I would certainly abolish ICE, but I also think – and I also think there's a whole – you know, I mean, look, one of the things that – you know, AMLO's promise to do in Mexico is demilitarize Mexico's border with Guatemala. And he basically said, look, we're not going to do, you know, your dirty work anymore. But to be really clear, like, there's a lot of steps in between here. Demilitarizing a border does not mean that, like, you say, look, we're going to get in accordance with international law on refugees. We're not going to have an empowered independent agency to terrorize families across the country.
Yeah. That's right.
And we're still going to, you know, yes, like there's still a process that, you know, we could check your passport, look at what you're bringing into the country. Like, none of this is necessitating, violence and militarism in any way, shape or form. And it really is. I mean, you know, this is also why. I mean, obviously, I oppose things like NSA surveillance, you know, just on the merits. I do not trust that agency with that level of that type of unaccountable power and monitoring. But the other argument that you would, you know, people like me would make, and I never said Trump by name, but you would talk about, you know, policies like the NSA or even like deportations under Obama. And you would say, all right, guys, let's stipulate for a minute that Barack Obama is the perfect Confucian ruler of the world, and he never makes a mistake, and he's never wrong, and obviously I could, you know, even just me sort of vaguely criticizing him is super bad, which some people did get like about Obama, just as other people, you know, couldn't ever have a realistic analysis of Obama either that was fair to him, frankly. But, you know, I would say, okay, what happens when none of these programs are codified or accountable or scaled back, whether it's drones or NSA or ICE, and you elect a total lunatic Republican president? And the only part of that sentiment that I was wrong about was, you know, I didn't specifically predict what lunatic it would be until much
right.
later.
The level of lunacy was underestimated. Right.
Right. It was like,
right. Even in your worst case scenario, the level of lunacy was underestimated.
Right. Right. I didn't say, hey, you see that like orange face asshole who like is fantasizing about fingering his daughter? One day he's going to be in charge of all of these programs.
Yeah, I no, you're right. And the key is you know, for all these things, I mean, look, there's all, you want realistically, right? Assuming that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not going to be the president right away, right? She's got to wait 7 years anyway, right?
I think like, she's got a shot down the road, actually. She's got chops. But yes, you won't be waiting.
Well, she does have political skill. There's no question. So, but you want a policy where there are people in the room who are, I don't know, experts on immigration and immigration policy, and they need to have a voice in setting an administration policy. We know that doesn't exist here. We
right.
know that it's hardline immigration opponents and law enforcement. That's who makes up Trump's policy. That's
right.
it. Right? How much more money can I get? How many more guns can I get? What can I get? Can we get 10 tanks to patrol the border around El Paso? We'd love that. That will help. Right? Great. Terrific. And there's nobody there to say, here's a breakdown of who's coming across and why they're coming across. Right? That just does, that policy doesn't exist. Now, obviously, we know that was far more likely to exist under Obama, but I don't really know whether it did. And certainly Obama, at his lowest point in immigration, when he was, it should be said, because context is always relevant, desperate, as he always was, to make a deal. Right? So he got tough on immigration and then thinking, hey, now these guys will make a deal with me. Never getting until year six of his presidency, you know what? They don't. They're not interested in making a deal with me.
Well, I think there's a
there's so
much in what you just said that I just totally agree with, because I think that it's like there's a couple of this. Okay, so one is it's what happens now is there's a certain contingent of people who, you know, all they have is, oh my God, I miss Obama. And I'm sorry, that's just, it's just not good enough on any kind of assessment you could make, including for, you know, the reasons you outlined, including just even Obama's own misconceptions about what was happening. And the fact that the hardline policies that Obama pursued, again, are not only innately wrong, but they also are a precursor to the catastrophe we're in now. And then on the flip side, when you draw a false equivalency between Obama and Trump, at this point, not only are you talking about difference in degree, you're talking about differences in kind. Because even the worst things that Obama did with regards to immigration, as you say, were part of a fundamentally wrong-headed triangulation effort to achieve a deal which would have benefited millions of people. This
That's right.
effort of this administration is to engineer a white electorate, both to appease white nationalists and for others who are, you know, I don't think have the same ideological investments. They just see the terrain. Like, of course I want to suppress the vote. Of course I want to ethnically cleanse America because I want to win, and we're a white identity party. And that is a fundamental difference. I do think moving forward, though, what people should understand is that, you know, Democrats can afford to pursue a very humane and progressive border policy, not just ethically, but politically, because I don't think, like, the people who thought Obama was weak on the border, it's because of his name and his skin color, not because of any reality of what happened at the border, right? Like, it's all identity politics.
Yeah, mostly. I mean, you know, toward the end, you had reasons to think that policy was that he was too lenient, not so much at the border, but on immigration in general, and you know, creating the Dreamers, like, you know, so there was.
But that's
a hard right position.
If you oppose the Dreamers, you're on the hard right, right? Like, that's not a moderate position. That's a hard right position.
No, right. Yeah. There are no right. Every you know, Obama took, you know, literally, you know, I mean, he took, there are a few liberal positions. He took and progressive positions. He took a gazillion moderate positions, and every one of them was categorized as crazed liberal from the right. So, you know, again, the lesson which so many mainstream Democrats seem incapable of learning is it doesn't matter what you do. They're going to call you a communist. So do something
Precisely.
Good.
Precisely. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. See, and this is we are the perfect example, I think, of the liberal socialist tag team, Ben. I think we just nail it every time, frankly. And it's this kind of coalition that could win, along with a lot of Poconos humor. You're also, of course, the great host for Turner Classic Movies. And well, actually, yeah. So you haven't seen Succession yet? We were texting about that.
No, I'm not. I've been three or four people in the last 5 days have berated me for not yet watching.
Wait, did Jank berate you? Of course, it's a great show.
Yeah. He's like, what's wrong with you? Why? I can't believe you are not watching this show.
I have to be honest with you. I was kind of shocked.
Yeah, no, I know. I just because we stopped reviewing so many of these shows. I mean, obviously, we would have reviewed it, too, on our show, What the Flick, on the TYT
Network. I like What the Flick. I was actually...
So we should have anyway. I missed it. We'll get season.
I'm not
two.
A huge fan of it, to be honest with you. So I actually was kind of like, wow, I'm seeing this, and Ben is not. That is very odd.
I watch a lot of television. I watch a lot of things, a lot of TV, a lot of movies in my life.
You know what's relaxing about Succession is that all of the characters are so unlikable that none of the stress of the show matters to you. Because you're like, literally all these people could die in a jet crash and it would make no emotional impact on me. So I can you can just watch from this incredible emotional distance while they like, you know, backstab each other because it doesn't matter.
I'm a little like my father. My father always, you know, he's a really smart, sophisticated guy. But any movie he ever saw, any TV show, he had trouble following things as smart as he was. He didn't quite get how stories were told visually.
Right.
He always thinks whatever you're seeing happened right after the thing you just saw.
Ah, okay.
So if you mess with time at all, even like a couple of hours, he said, well, how do they not know where he is? He left the building. They have a guy. I'm like, Dad, no, this is them. Never mind. Right? And God forbid they put anything up on the screen that put a date up.
He'd be like, what does that mean?
Like, I mean, that means it's now 1943, but yeah. It was just 1980. I know. Now it's 1943. I don't know.
He's like, no, it's not.
And he felt like he had to have somebody to root for. And if there's nobody to root for, he wasn't into it.
Yeah, I kind of get that, actually. And I wonder, we've gone a little overboard maybe with the like, all right, enough of the moral conflict and nobody's clean. Like, I think Billions pulls that off because it does a good job at sort of making different people likable at different times. And a guy like, you know, so that kind of works. But I think maybe we've gone a little overboard with that.
No, the great thing about Billions, again, yeah. I think is that there are times when you hate both Giamatti and Damian Lewis. And then times when you're like, what happened here? I'm on Damian Lewis's side, and I don't understand what he's doing, and two, I know it's morally corrupt, but somehow I'm into it. And then you root for right. these characters, guys like Dollar Bill. Like, I want a whole show about Dollar Bill managing his two families. That's the show I would watch.
That would be an awesome spin-off.
100 episodes of, and I figure one of his wives is jealous of the other, and the other one just doesn't care. And at one point, she turns to him and says, like, don't talk to me like that. Who do you think I am, Rachel? You know,
I'm the wife who doesn't care. I think, that's a great example because on the show, I love that guy. In real life, I would literally send him to a work camp.
So that's it. Yeah, totally. I got you. That's exactly right.
Show, he's awesome. And when he smashed that guy's car, I almost clapped. If you know what scene I'm talking about.
I do, totally. Yeah.
The compliance officer's car, that was one of my favorite scenes in the whole show.
Yeah, that guy's in the guy whose car he slammed is also in Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, I could see that. I haven't watched Handmaid's Tale because I just can't take more
stuff.
Negativity,
could,
but I believe
you
can, it.
You'd be into it. You'd
I buy
you
it.
Can handle it.
I believe
You're
it.
You're grown up. You can handle it.
You're grown up. You can handle it. All right. What, besides Handmaid's Tale, do you have a movie recommendation for us?
Oh, yeah. Eighth Grade, man. Eighth Grade is phenomenal.
Tell me about
it. Bo Burnham, his first film for, you know, he's been a sort of a YouTube darling, but it's the first film he wrote and directed it. And it's about an eighth grade girl and her dad. He's a single dad raising her, but it's really about her sort of, and she's super awkward. She was, you know, an eighth grade graduation. She was named, you know, most shy, you know, and she's like mortified, but she makes these YouTube self-help videos that get 15 viewers, but she's kind of lively in the videos, but cool. She does not know how to sort of manage herself in life. And uh-huh. It is just, I mean, it is a beautiful, occasionally heartsick, occasionally heartwarming movie. And it's like 88 minutes. I mean, it's great. It's a 10. It's as good a teenage adolescent movie as I've ever seen.
Eighth grade. It's in the theaters now?
In theaters now, most places. It's slowly rolled out, but I think it's in 15 or 20 cities now. So it's a good chance you have a chance that your listeners have a chance to see it.
All right, I will definitely go see it.
Your coastal elite listeners probably have a chance to see it.
The coastal elite listeners, this is a message only for the coastal elites. Have you seen Sorry to Bother You yet, Ben?
No, I have not seen Sorry to Bother You. I was going to mention one, which
really
I know is
good.
Interesting,
and
I'm anxious to see that too. Yeah. Also, Rob Reiner's movie, it's not great, but Shock and Awe, about the Knight Ridder reporters who got the run up to the Iraq War right.
Cool, I do want to see that.
And I mean, it's good because it's an important story. That movie's also short. It probably should be longer. Journalism movies are tough because it's guys making phone calls. And it's just a reminder that a few people did get this right in the wave of Judy Miller et al. Who got it wrong. And these guys still aren't on every Sunday show.
No.
Like, that's what gets me, is that they got it. They were good reporters. They were solid. They were like, hey, they've formed this secret intelligence cabal, and they're sort of freezing out other intelligence, and they're just determined to go to war in Iraq and to tie Saddam to 9/11. And none of this is probably true. And I mean, in a sense, these guys should be, and their editor, who Rob Reiner also plays in the movie, like, they should be celebrated, right? Like, in the face of enormous opposition, they did it right. And, you know, they're still working, but why aren't they hosting CBS Sunday morning? Why isn't Warren Seibold the head of, this week with Warren Seibold instead of George Stephanopoulos? I'm not knocking George, but these guys should be being feted.
100%. I mean, my God, not only are they not, we still have the same cast of people who propagandized for the invasion on all the time. And in some cases, even their friggin' kids. And, you know, besides Meghan McCain, I have to say, besides her unintentional, incredible boost she's doing for democratic socialism in this country, every time she opens her mouth, I mean, it is kind of awe-inspiring, right? It's like, we can't even... Forget even holding, you know, the dad accountable for his role in that stuff. We're not even going to – we're going to skip the people who got it right and go straight to the nepotism jobs. I mean, it is pretty stunning.
Yeah, it's worth seeing. But Eighth Grade is a truly, truly great American film.
Eighth Grade, Ben Mankiewicz, Turner Classic Movies, The Young Turks. It's always such a pleasure talking with you, my friend.
You too, Michael. Thanks.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, guys. I think what we're going to do – should we wait till the fun half to start this war with Trevor Noah?
Yeah, we're
all right, we're going to do the war with Trevor Noah, and then I got it again. We're definitely not going to get to all calls today. I am sorry, but it's just there's a lot of calls in this era.
It's too popular.
MR, it's really growing.
Well, you know what's? I think
when Trump does stuff like that, where he's just like getting pop, it's growing.
What's going to happen, I think, is what happens with sort of radio shows that have been around for 15 years. And some of our callers have sort of like learned a little sort of like how you do a call and in and out.
We've got some real pros.
It basically is, it's an evolutionary process.
It's an evolutionary process.
People
it's
decide
science.
What works and what doesn't.
You're going to adapt or you're not going to adapt.
I think the best show with Tom Sharplin is the best for calls. Like they move through some calls on that show.
Well, I too have been known to move through some calls. I've definitely seen some bitching.
But they have the understanding with their audience that like this might seem rude.
I almost never mean it to be.
It's a gauntlet.
Actually, let me say, I think we all know who I meant it to be rude for. I had to see off Greg, and that was definitely meant to be rude and disrespectful in every way, shape, and form. Old man racist, rude. And a couple of others. For everybody else, I love you. I'm sorry. I just got to keep it moving. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Just Coffee for Fair Trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show today, this Sunday. An illicit history of trade from Ricardo to Trump with Zach Carter. Listen back to dozens of illicit histories on Iran, Jamaica, CLR, James, plus Woke Bros with Waz, plus the post game, and go subscribe to the new Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel, where we are clipping lots of segments from the show, including Nelson Mandela owned Zionist. Patreon.com/TMBS. This Tuesday, Anna Kasparian and I are dissing Dave Rubin. That's been in the works for a very long time, and it's going to be very harsh. Antifada, what's up?
Yeah, so our new episode is now up. It's on the National Welfare Rights Organization and Marxist Feminism.
Good.
I'm also very excited to announce that we have blown past our initial goal of 183 patrons, which means we have now released a trailer for our soon-to-be-released debut of our epic cooking show, Acid Kitchen. It's on our newly launched YouTube channel, which will soon have all the free episodes as well. And we're also going to be on Spotify and a thing called Stitcher soon. So get stoked.
Sweet. I feel I have to get the gushing out first.
Okay.
Literally. Sound drop before we even play the clip. Wow.
I love it. We're so...
We're not actually playing that clip.
Oh, we're not? No.
We're saving that for some other godforsaken time.
Yeah, for Dave Rubin Duncan.
Ruben dunking. All right, Matt, Literary Hangover. What's up? What's going on?
Yeah, there's a new episode, Young Goodman Brown. Check it out on YouTube and also all the places you can find podcasts, except Spotify. I'm not on there. But it's almost appropriate.
I think it kind of works.
And patreon.com/literaryhangover. Also on Twitter, I don't plug this because I'm annoyed that I didn't get the... I can't fit Literary Hangover. That's one character over the limit, so it's at Lit Hangover. Ah. So you can follow it there.
We will be right back on the Majority Report. Are we going to play one of our fun new break songs? Nope, La Poupée? All right.